The National Archives podcast series, Fanny and Stella, the young men who shocked Victorian England, presented by Neil McKenna. This talk was recorded as part of LGBTQ History Month on the 19th of February 2015 at the National Archives, Kew.
Hi, hi everybody. Thank you very much for coming. Okay, now Vicky did her health and safety and housekeeping. I've got my health and safety and public housekeeping warnings. When I did a talk about this at the Literary Society in a small hall there, with nearly 200 people, the average age was about 80, and the organiser had very thoughtfully provided not one but two defibrillators. So, you know, I sort of said afterwards, why were there two? And they said, well, we thought that one might not be enough given the content of your book. So I just passed that on. So if anyone has a weak heart and is going to be damaged or upset, you might leave now. When I launched the book at Gaze the Word bookshop in Marchmont Street, it was very crowded, but as I was talking about anal fistula, a lesbian fainted and had to be carried out by a posse of six lesbians, and she was only revived when cold lager was applied to her temples. And then at Waterstones, about a week later, I was doing a talk, and a woman got up and muttering, sort of, I don't know what she was muttering, not very nice things, she sort of stomped out. And then in the Daily Express, that paragon of liberal, relaxed values, a woman reviewed the book, and I quote from her review, "Do be warned," she wrote, "it is very, very explicit about what the men got up to and their medical examinations. I did not understand all the technical terms used to describe sexual practices either. I am no prude, but I had to skip over several passages." Which does beg the question which passages she's referring to, but I'll leave that thought with you. So anyway, that's my health warning. So those of a nervous disposition should leave now. Those who want an academic talk should leave now, because it ain't academic. In fact, the book is the very antithesis of academia, although I think it's impeccably researched, and it relies almost entirely on primary sources. And I would say 80% of those primary sources are actually here at the National Archives. I keep wanting to say the Public Record Office, because when I was a girl, it was the Public Record Office. So it's hard to get my tongue around the National Archive. But anyway, it was the Public Record Office. So if I say PRO, you'll know what I mean. So why did I write this book? That's what most people seem to want to know. Well, I wrote a book called The Secret Life of Oscar Wilde a very long time ago, which was really my first biography. I'd been a journalist, I'd done lots and lots of journalism, and I'd written a book about HIV and AIDS in the developing world, which was rather grim and a depressing area to write about. I was working for an AIDS charity, and I was editing a magazine about AIDS in the third world. And I used to get home and feel stressed, and I used to have tummy aches and things like that. And I realized that actually it was quite a depressing area. It wasn't really an area of good news. And I did it for 2 years, and then I did this book about men having sex with men and HIV, which was even more gloomy and depressing, if that was possible, because there was no money, no prevention, loads of homophobia, blah, 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 blah. So I thought, I must do something a bit different. So I left that job. In fact, I think they kicked me out because I was too difficult. And I went to work at Elle Decoration, which was a glossy interiors magazine, and that was probably the best antidote to the gloom of HIV and AIDS, because, you know, all we had to worry about was sort of colour schemes and samples. So that was that. And then I thought, you know, I got a job at Channel 4 doing stuff there, editing and writing booklets. But I'd always wanted to do a book on Oscar Wilde because I'd read about Oscar Wilde, and every biography that I read about Oscar Wilde gave the same sort of dreary story about Oscar Wilde being seduced into homosexuality by Robbie Ross in a public lavatory, supposedly, and then falling into bad company with terrible homosexuals, sodomites. And then it was syphilis, prison, exile, and death in that order, or any order you care to name. So it was all a terrible story. And yet when you read the letters of Oscar Wilde and when you read the life story, certain facts didn't fit. So I wanted to do a book about Oscar Wilde's journey towards his sexuality. And it was going to be a very short book. It was going to be 80 or 90,000 words. And it turned into nearly 300,000 words. So I did this book, and the book was quite successful. And then Mark Booth took me to lunch at the Ivy. And you know your book's done quite well when a publisher takes you to lunch at the Ivy, because normally it's a kind of curled up white sandwich, you know, and it's sort of stale and unpleasant and horrible coffee. But he actually took me to lunch at the Ivy and plied me with champagne. And I thought, oh, I wonder what's going to happen here. And he said, have you considered writing a book about Lawrence of Arabia? We'd really like to do one. And I was flattered by his attentions. My head is easily turned. So I said, yes, yes, or no, I think it's a great idea. So I went off and spent 6 months reading about Lawrence of Arabia and found actually that I couldn't do a book, that several books had been written, three rather good ones, a lot of terrible ones. But there wasn't anything new for me to discover. And I just thought, you know, I don't want to do a book that retreads and retreads and retreads, because it's not what I'm about. I'm basically a researcher. I like the process of research. I like finding out things. So I was a bit stuck, and I kept thinking, oh, I know, I'm going to do a book on this, I'm going to do a book on that. And then someone had already done it, it was about to be published, it had been announced, or someone had done one 2 years earlier. So I was really stuck. And then one morning, about a year later, I woke up and thought of Fanny and Stella. And that I'd mentioned them in my Oscar Wilde book as these two young men who'd been prosecuted for conspiracy to commit sodomy. And that I'd read a couple of quotes of their letters, which are in the National Archive. There's a small file of letters. And there was a letter from Fanny to Lord Arthur Clinton. That's Fanny there, who is on the plain side, saying, have you had my umbrella repaired? I cannot go outside in this terrible wet weather without a dread of my back curl coming loose. And I thought, you know, there's something rather kind of interesting and engaging. And I thought to myself, I wonder if there's a story that I can tell about them. I wonder if there's any material. So I started researching using what was called the National Register of Archives, but I don't think that exists anymore. That's another thing that's gone. And discovered that there was a trial transcript and some letters and some documents here in the National Archives. So I rushed here, pre-ordered in advance, and got this box, which was that thick, and I opened it, and out came this transcript of the state trial of Fanny and Stella. And it was, you know, it's about 8 inches thick. And I'm not a size queen, but even I was daunted. And it's very interesting, the whole process of how and why this material had survived, when so much didn't survive. So much was lost, so much was thrown, so much was burnt, so much was abandoned, so much wasn't even recorded. But somebody, at some point, within government or in the court system or whatever had decided that this trial was of interest. So at the state trial of Fanny and Stella, someone from, I can't remember the name, Messrs. Somebody or other in Westminster, which was a firm that specialised in providing shorthand writers, had sent a team of shorthand writers to take this trial down in shorthand. And then somebody had actually transliterated from the shorthand into longhand. And if you look at that, you can look at it, there are about 8 or 9 clerkly hands. So there are different sets of handwriting throughout this bound trial. And some of it was really very difficult to read, and some of it was really quite easy to read. But it took an awful long time for me to get it all down because I'm a completist. So I decided I had to copy the whole thing. So I made many, 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 many trips here in all sorts of weathers, sitting at those desks. And I always find the lighting here very, very hard on the eyes. It's very, this fluorescent lighting, if you spend more than 3 hours in it, it kills your eyes. You feel terrible afterwards, don't you? I always get a migraine. And I have memories of going back home on various routes, sometimes on the tube, sometimes on the overground, with a headache, you know, my eyes feeling really, really drained. But anyway, what was exciting was that I found this material, and it was very, very interesting, because as a gay man, in case any of you didn't realise I was gay, I am gay, and too butch, I pass as straight, people tell me. As a gay man, I've always had this problem with my gay history. A, there's very little of it. It's not been recorded, and it's been forced into the underground, into the darkness, into secrecy, because until 1967, when we had partial decriminalisation, it was a terrible criminal offence. And we forget that now. It's very easy how quickly people forget. You know, we repeal a bad law that has prevailed for nearly 1,000 years, and now suddenly everything is sort of relaxed and easy. And actually, in my life, I've gone through my life from being criminal as a child to being partially decriminalised to now having civil rights, civil partnerships, and now equal marriage. So it's been a tremendous journey over my lifetime, and I'm only 32. So, you know, I think we forget how difficult life was. And that, in historical terms, that has meant that much of my gay history, my past as a gay man, much of the lesbian past, much of the transgendered past, has been obliterated, hidden, not recorded, lost, or suppressed. And the only history that we have, really, is the history of crime and punishment and criminality and prison sentences and books about how terrible gay men are and how terrible lesbianism is and legal processes. But when I was transcribing the trial of Fanny and Stella and reading the letters, I suddenly realised that there was a window into the lives of two very, very, very silly, very foolish young queens who were kind of prancing around in drag, being wildly promiscuous, getting into all sorts of mischief in the late 1860s, early 1870s. Here was an opportunity to sort of almost excavate two gay lives which hadn't been told. They weren't famous. They weren't particularly talented. They weren't writers. They weren't great artists. They were drag queens, more or less. We can argue about what you call them. But here was an opportunity to be able to tell the lives of two gay men living in a time of incredible hostility I mean, I think the death penalty for sodomy was repealed in something like 1858 or so. I can't remember. I've got it. It's in the book. You can read it in the book. It's written down. There hadn't been an execution for, I think, 30 or 40 years, but the fact that the death penalty was around even when these guys were born was incredible. And of course, the penalty was for sodomy was life imprisonment, and the penalty for other sort of sexual crimes were 10 years to life. So it wasn't an easy business, and yet they lived their lives. They were completely out of the closet. They didn't care, and they had an absolute ball. So that's what attracted me to them, and I wanted to tell that story because I think history, and we are in Gay History Month here, history is told by the victors, not by the victims. So my job, really, as a gay man and as a sort of historian, is to tell that story, is to tell the story of the victims, not of the victors, and to somehow reclaim that gay past. And I think with Fanny and Stella, I was able to do that. And I think the other thing that came out of it was that lots of things that are fugitive, like the idea of camp, and you probably all have heard the word camp, and some of you might even have an idea of what it means or a personal idea. Lots of people use the word camp. Lots of straight people use the word camp when they see gay men. They say, oh, they're very camp. But I think that actually camp as a concept and as a cultural force is really quite important. And buried deep in the letters and the transcripts and various other bits of research, I came across the origins of the word camp and the origins of the word drag. Drag was used in various state witness statements and things like that. So it was around 1860 when the word drag came in. And camp was also used. Now, if you look up the Oxford English Dictionary, the one that's in two volumes with a magnifying glass, I think it's called the Shorter English Oxford English Dictionary, but it's two big heavy volumes that you have to lift up and you get a little magnifying glass. It's probably online now. But if you look it up, it says that the first use of the word camp in the sense of pertaining to effeminacy and homosexuality was used in about 1918 or something like that. Actually, it's used in a letter from Fanny to Lord Arthur Clinton where she says, oh, thank you for the birthday present. You didn't need to buy me anything. I'm Stella's sister. My campish undertakings are not at present meeting with the success they deserve. And then also there was a letter a few years later from an Irish male prostitute called Malcolm Johnson, but his camp name was the Maid of Athens. And he wrote a letter to his father in Dublin. Depending on your view of male prostitution, you know, Irish male prostitutes are either the best or the worst. I mean, I think they're the best. They're the most outrageous. There are two Irish male prostitutes who feature in this book. Jack Saul, who's an Irish male prostitute, who wrote Sins of the Cities of the Plain, Recollections of a Mary Ann, which may or may not have been written by him, but Jack Saul was a real male prostitute. And he was interviewed 18 years later in connection with the Cleveland Street scandal, and his witness statement is somehow buried somewhere in this building, and it's well worth fishing it out because he talks very openly. He says, you know, I've been a Mary Ann for 20 years, and, you know, 20 years ago when I first came to London, you know, I could walk out and I could earn £8 or £9 a week, you know, going with gentlemen, it was no trouble. Now, I'm older, I've got to pound the streets, it's almost impossible, you know. I'm worn out, you know. It's very, very funny. So, anyway, So that's one male prostitute. The other male prostitute was Malcolm Johnson, the maid of Athens. And he wrote this letter to his pa in Dublin. Probably, we don't know the date, it's undated, but probably about 1875, 1876. So a few years after Fanny and Stella. He wrote, "Dear Pa, I have been in the hands of the police. Don't be frightened. Or rather the other way round, the police have been in my hands so many times lately that my lily-white hands have been trembling and I am utterly fucked out." Such camp. So that's quite interesting that you discover the use of the word camp and you understand that it's a kind of cultural force. When he was arrested by the police, Malcolm Johnson was arrested by the police rather than taken by the police in another way. When he was arrested by the police and interrogated about that letter, he was asked what camp meant. And he said, camp means amusement. It can mean proper or improper amusement. So that's quite nice. It's quite nice to go back to the meanings of these sort of valences and things that are very, very fugitive and transient and passing. And even now, since I was young, I think the meaning of the word camp has changed. And Polari, that sort of gay language, is sort of almost dead. You know, nobody under 40 really uses Polari anymore. And a lot of Polari words have been sort of hijacked into sort of heterosexual language, like rough trade, which is Polari, you know, is now common language. Drama queen is now part of the common language. So that's the whole process of writing the book was, I mean, I hate writing anyway. I mean, it's an absolute nightmare. I don't get any enjoyment. And you hear writers interviewed on the radio saying, oh, you know, I love writing. I get up at 6 a.m, I do 4 hours writing and I write 5,000 words a day and it's the best time. You know, I hate it. I get up, I think, oh God, life is so horrible. I have my breakfast, I go back to bed, and my pussycat Lupin, who's beautiful, who's a Singaporean, comes back to bed with me and we cuddle for half an hour and then we try again. We get up and see if we can face the day. And then I sort of flop round in a sort of soiled nightie. I don't have a fag hanging out of my mouth because I don't smoke anymore. And I sort of gradually do it. So it is a struggle to write. It's not an easy thing. But even though I found this book very difficult to do, because to structure it, to make the narrative work. And then the reaction to the book, I think, was also very interesting. I mean, the book was incredibly widely reviewed. I think it was reviewed by every national newspaper, even the Financial Times. It was reviewed by The Telegraph, The Times, The Guardian, and then The Express, The Daily Mail, The Evening Standard, blah, 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 blah. And most of those reviews were positive, but they all had a little kind of critical current. And that critical current was that the book was too graphic. So they all said the same thing. They loved it, it was vibrant, it was funny, it was exciting, it was a great read, but it's just a little too graphic. And the other criticism was it was too camp. So I, in my naivety, I thought that writing a book about two young drag queens who go around London having as much sex as they possibly can, catching syphilis, gonorrhea, and getting anal fistulas, having drag balls and all the rest of it, there might have to be a little bit of camp in there. But apparently not. You can't have that. You can't have the camp. And you can't have the graphic stuff about anal sex because that won't do either. And I think that's a funny point, but I think it also illustrates quite an important point about gay history, lesbian history, transgender history, that although I can be published by a mainstream publisher, which is, this book is unthinkable even 20 years ago, 40 years ago, I'd have probably been prosecuted, thrown into Pentonville prison, and gang raped. So although the book is thinkable now rather than unthinkable, publishable rather than unpublishable, there are still constraints and barriers. I have to mind my P's and Q's. It can't be too camp. It can't be too joyous. It can't celebrate anal sex. It can't be too graphic, as they call it. Although I don't think the book was graphic. I mean, I know what graphic is. I'm a gay man of a certain age. I know what graphic is. But you can't. And I think that's a very, very important and interesting point about tolerance, etc., etc., etc. So I was quite interested by that, the whole reception of the book. I mean, when it was reviewed by gay people, they said exactly the opposite. It's not camp enough. It's not graphic enough. We want more details of anal sex and anal desire and STDs. So you can't win. But I do think it's quite interesting from my perspective as a gay writer who's struggled quite a lot in a heterosexual world in my life, that although we are technically now equal, we're not equal. There are barriers, there are limits to what you can say and what you can write about and how what people will publish. Now, I'm going to take some questions, but before I do that, I just want to read you a very short chapter, if you can bear it. It's a self-contained chapter. So you don't need to have read the book. You don't need to know what's gone before or what's gone afterwards, other than Stella was Ernest Bolton. Fanny was Frederick Park. They were best friends, sisters, drag queens, blah, blah, blah. And that Lord Arthur Clinton, the son of the 5th Duke of Newcastle, was Stella's lover. And he was a bit of a, he was an MP, but a bankrupt and a bit of a waste of space. But anyway, he was a lord, which was quite important. So it's very, very short. It's called The Dragon of Davis Street. Miss Anne Empson was a lady of singular, not to say startling, appearance. She was tall and spare and grey, and she scowled a great deal. And when she was not scowling, her face wore a fell and determined expression, as if life were a battle that must be fought to the bitterest of bitter ends. Miss Anne Empson was conspicuously unmarried, and it was clear from the very severe and resolute tone with which she declared her state of spinsterhood in court that she had never contemplated matrimony and never would, which came as something of a relief to London's eligible bachelors, as Miss Empson was not an easy person, not at all an easy person. Miss Anne Empson maintained a small establishment at No. 46 Davis Street in the fashionable environs of Bond Street, where she condescended to let lodgings, chambers as she grandly termed them, to suitable single gentlemen with an irreproachable character. But such suitable single gentlemen rarely stayed for long after they discovered in very short order that Miss Anne Empson was a fire-breathing dragon, clearly descended from a long and distinguished line of fire-breathing dragons. There were long lists of rules and regulations, strictly enforced and invigilated by the indefatigable Miss Empson herself, who policed and patrolled her kingdom with admirable, if fearsome, zeal. Infringements and infractions rarely, if ever, escaped detection, and were punished by a vigorous tongue-lashing or by summary expulsion from her kingdom, and very often by both. Miss Empson constantly seethed and was always out of temper. If it was not this, it was that. If it was not one thing, it was another. If it was not something, then it was someone giving her cause for complaint. She fumed and smouldered and burned with perpetual indignation and rage at the world, so much so that there were those who swore they detected a faint bituminous odour about her, though it was more likely that these sulphurous exhalations were a consequence of the numerous nips of brandy she felt it necessary to imbibe throughout the day to help settle her stomach. Miss Anne Empson was still seething, still fuming, even after all this time. It was disgusting. There was no other word for it. She felt physically sick every time she thought about it. Under her roof, in her bed, not her bed exactly, but near enough, It had all begun so well. Lord Arthur Pelham Clinton seemed to fit the bill perfectly. Blood, after all, was blood, and having little or none of that commodity coursing in her own veins, Miss Empson was all the more eager to have a resident gentleman of irreproachable bloodstock. Lord Arthur was a lord, the son of the late Duke of Newcastle, no less, and an honourable member to boot. What with it being so close to Christmas, Miss Empson had been resigned to not getting a let for the drawing room floor until after the festive season had passed. And then Lord Arthur had turned up out of the blue and charmed and delighted her so much that she was putty, yes, putty in his hands. Indeed, so charming and so delightful had he been that she had waived her usual month's deposit and even advanced him the not inconsiderable sum of 10 golden sovereigns on a note of hand. In retrospect, she thought she must have taken temporary leave of her senses. Either that or Lord Arthur had unusual powers of mesmerism, which he had exercised in order to make her agree to things that went so very much against the grain. Matters had not stopped there. Incredibly, given her strict and sacred injunctions against overnight visitors in any shape or form, Miss Empson found herself weakly agreeing to allow Lord Arthur's country cousin, a Mr. Ernest Bolton, to stay in Davies Street on those occasions when he was up in town. And she was even persuaded to buy, yes, buy, a single bed for that express purpose. As she said, she was putty in his hands. Putty. Things started to go wrong almost immediately. Lord Arthur moved in, and within a day or two she had smelled a rat, or rather, two rats, in the form of the two young men, though that was rather a loose description, who arrived very shortly after him. One of them was Mr. Bolton, the country cousin, the other a Mr. Park, but she could not remember which was not at all surprising, as they seemed to be two peas from more or less the same pod. All she could say with any certainty was that one was dark and one was fair, and that one was pretty and the other plain. The manner of Miss Anne Empson's giving evidence at Bow Street Magistrates Court was refreshingly bracing. "Are you married?" Mr. Straightforth, the defence, gently inquired of her after she was sworn. "Certainly not," she replied with a snort of contempt. "I am a single woman," she said, glaring at the assembled multitude, daring any or all to contradict her. It was clear from her abrasive tone that Miss Empson was angry and aggrieved and spoiling for a fight. Mr. Strait tried another tack. "Have you been drinking this morning?" he asked. It was a reasonable enough question. The unhealthy pallor that so many fashionable young ladies struggled to achieve by dint of draughts of strong vinegar and copious quantities of ingested chalk was emphatically not exhibited by Miss Anne Empson. She spurned such fashionable conceits and instead defiantly sported a ruddy and flushed complexion, entirely congruent with numerous nips of brandy. There was something, too, about the way she slurred certain words, about the gleam and the glaze of her eyes, and about the fixity of her fell expression, which suggested she had not, for the time being at least, taken the pledge. "Have you been drinking this morning?" Mr. Strait asked her. "I could not speak so well as I do if I had," Miss Empson replied combatively. There was loud laughter. For some reason, spectators crammed into Bow Street appeared to find Miss Empson funny, and she had barely to open her mouth before guffaws of laughter broke out. Miss Empson was simultaneously offended and pleased by the laughter and played up to it wonderfully. "You had better answer the question," Mr. Flowers, the magistrate, sternly interjected. "Have you been to a public house today?" demanded Mr. Strait. "On my oath, I have not," answered Miss Empson, swaying slightly. "I have not had any drink at home. A policeman brought me here in a cab, but I don't know who it was." There was much more in the same vein, but slowly, with much difficulty, Mr. Strait got down to the meat and drink of Miss Anne Empson's evidence. Lord Arthur Clinton had lodged with her for a fortnight before she was obliged to evict him. Shortly after he had taken possession of his rooms, his young cousin from the country had turned up and enjoyed a mutton chop and bitter beer at Lord Arthur's expense and had stayed the night. So far, so good. Miss Empson rarely hesitated when it came to exercising her ancient rights and privileges as a landlady, and regularly entered her tenants' apartments for a good snoop round while they were out. So on the morning after his country cousin had spent the night, Miss Empson found herself in Lord Arthur's bedroom feeling puzzled and perplexed. "I was surprised," she said, "to see that the new bed I had bought had not been slept in." Had Lord Arthur's cousin changed his mind and returned to the country? It was possible. But a thorough examination of the bedding suggested that the country cousin had slept with Lord Arthur in the same bed, which raised some very unpleasant speculations in her mind. A night or two later, while on one of her regular patrols, Miss Empson had seen a woman coming out of Lord Arthur's rooms, which was strictly forbidden under the draconian laws of the establishment. "I saw Lord Arthur go on tiptoe to let her out," she said. "I saw him through the kitchen stairs letting a lady out, as I considered. I complained to Lord Arthur that he had brought a woman into my house. He said it was a man. Lord Arthur assured me it was a man. He represented him as his cousin." But Miss Empson was quite certain of what she had seen. There was no two ways about it. It was a woman. "I complained of it as an abuse of my latchkey," Miss Empson declared indignantly, much to the amusement of the public gallery. But shocking and disgusting as the presence of this woman in her house was, at least it put pay to those earlier and very unpleasant speculations. A day or so later, she had caught the two young men, Mr. Bolton and Mr. Park, in the very act of moving in, which again was strictly forbidden. This sort of cheap trick might pass unnoticed in certain common lodging houses, but it would not do in Davis Street. It would not do at all. There they were, bold as brass, in Lord Arthur's rooms with their boxes just brought up and about to be unpacked. Miss Empson confronted them. "I said to them, 'You have brought your boxes up and I will make you take them down.' I did so. One of them turned round and said, 'I wish never to see your house again.' And I replied, 'I'll take good care you don't.' He said, 'Why not?' And I replied, 'Because I let the rooms to Lord Arthur Pelham Clinton.' 'I'm not having this,' she told them in no uncertain terms. 'I will not have it. I shall not have it.'" Miss Empson was ruddy with the glow of this remembered triumph and glared out defiantly at the courtroom, armed and ready to repel all boarders, doubters and naysayers. Not long after this, Miss Empson mounted an expedition deep into the heart of Lord Arthur's territory. No stone was to be left unturned, no drawer unopened, no letter unread. She went through everything with a fine tooth comb. She pried and probed and poked about her, and she was rewarded, if that was the right word, by the discovery of an entire wardrobe of ladies' wearing apparel. Miss Empson put two and two together. It dawned upon her that when Lord Arthur said that the woman he had surreptitiously let out was a man, he was almost certainly telling the truth. Miss Empson was shocked and revolted. Under her roof, in her bed. If that was their pretty game, then they were out on their ears that very night. Of one thing she was sure, she would need a nip or two of brandy, and probably several nips, before her stomach could be settled that night. In Bow Street Magistrate's Court, Miss Empson was confused. Bolton and Park were there in the dock, and she recognised them both as the two young men she had turned out. One was dark and one was fair. One was plain and one was pretty, though not so pretty now, she noticed with satisfaction. But which was Bolton and which was Park? Lord Arthur had told her that his country cousin was called Bolton, but surely this could not be so. In court, Bolton had been identified as the dark, pretty one, but she was as sure as sixpence that the young man who had spent the night in Lord Arthur's bed, the young man whom she had seen dressed as a woman, was the plain, fair one. She pointed to him, the dock. "The prisoner nearest to me, Park, who I call Bolton, is the one who slept with Lord Arthur," she said. "That is the one. It is the one with the golden hair." Fanny shifted uncomfortably on the hard wooden bench of the dock as she was fingered by the redoubtable Miss Empson. She did not like to be reminded so graphically of her all too brief and doomed liaison with her sister's husband. Needless to say, Arthur had fallen at the first fence. Under interrogation by Stella, he had crumpled and confessed all, and even tried to save his own sorry and scrawny neck by implying that it was Fanny who had made all the running. Stella had been incandescent with rage. She did not know which was worse, Arthur's infidelity or Fanny's betrayal. But if she blamed anyone, she blamed Fanny. Arthur was weak, indecisive, and painfully susceptible to flattery. Stella could well imagine how Fanny had flattered and simpered and simpered and flattered until poor foolish Arthur did not know whether he was coming or going, at which point Fanny would have pounced like a cat on its unsuspecting prey. There had been tears and tantrums, scenes and slappings. Arthur was devastated and appalled. Fanny could only hang her head in shame and beg her sister's forgiveness. But Stella was adamant. She renounced her husband, disowned her sister, and did what all sensible married women should do in such circumstances. She went home to her mama. So, that was that chapter, which gives you a flavour, I think, of the book.
This podcast is copyright to the National Archives, rights reserved. It is available for reuse under the terms of the Open Government License.